page numbers that I gave you from volume one, so I don't know how we'll actually compensate that, but the I'll try and give them in terms of section numbers. Hopefully the section numbers haven't changed between the two volumes, but if they did, then we'll have to figure out how to correct that. That's one comment. Then I wanted to, some questions came up after the class last time and otherwise. I also realized that there were a couple of things I wanted to say. So in particular, you said that many people still felt confused about all these distinctions between gauge invariants and gauge transformations and symmetries and so on. So I don't want to dwell on it too much because maybe it'll become more clear later on. As I say that, I don't know when we would actually get to that. So it'll be a while. But let me just say a couple of things and then see that I had wanted to say anyway and forgot to say, just very short things. The first one is just a sort of point of view on what, so just as this is just a comment on what sort of the underlying meaning behind having a gauge invariance, and that is that it's what it means in some sense. This is not sharp exactly, it's more of a philosophical nature, but maybe it helps to guide thinking about what it means, is that the points of the manifold they, in some sense, they lack individuality. Another way of saying it is that they're just carriers for the other things, for the dynamical, in this case, for the dynamical and the background variables. They're just carriers for the other structures. So that includes the topology, the fields, and so on. When I say they lack individuality, it means you sort of can't really tell one from the other. The only way you can tell one point of space-time from another point of space-time is that the fields there are different. But if you didn't have those fields to refer to, there'd be really no way of telling one from the other. Even if you took the fields away, there's still something left, and that's this topology and this differentiable structure. That's more subtle to say exactly what it means, but one way of saying it roughly is that even though they lack individuality and you can't tell which one is which, you can in some sense tell which ones are close to which ones in some limiting sense of topology. But the fact that we have the diffeomorphism invariance, if we regard that as a gauge invariance, basically can be viewed as the statement that the points, just what I said here, that intrinsically you can't tell one from the other. See, if they carried coordinates, for example, that would, if there was a real physical coordinate system laid down, then of course, and that was part of the structure of the manifold, then of course you could tell one from the other because you could just look at the number. Okay. So that's just another way of thinking about what the underlying meaning is. And another way of saying, another thing that's true of gauge invariance that also helps to elucidate its meaning is that it means that in some sense, our description is redundant. Our description contains extraneous elements. And it's those elements which change when you perform a diffeomorphism. So we're describing the same physical situation in more than one way. And since you might ask, why are we forced to do that? That's an interesting question. Why is it somehow easier to describe objects in space-time and the objects that general relativity deals with in this redundant way, or why is it easier to describe the electromagnetic field in terms of a vector potential, which has redundant information, gauge information, than it is to describe it directly in terms of gauge invariant things? That's probably a deep question, but in any case, and it has something to do with locality, is what experience seems to have shown. But in any case, it's an aspect of gauge. It's another way of thinking about what gauge invariance means. Okay, so those are just sort of remarks more at the level of intuition or philosophy. Now, was there any... Then I want to say something a little about gauge invariant versus symmetry, and then go on, return to cosmology. But was there some question... If there was some more sharply formulated form of the confusion that seems to have percolated through people's, then I could try and address that also.
In like a traditional gauge theory,
right?
You need only a connection, whereas in general relativity, you need both the metric and the connection.
Oh, that's a different issue. So we haven't defined those things yet. So maybe you should raise the question again when we have. But most of you know. So you're talking about the connection, which is represented either by the Christoffel symbol or by a covariant derivative symbol, versus the metric, which is represented, say,
maybe a more vague way of asking it is. There's sort of a connection
you're thinking about the parallel or lack of parallel between ordinary gauge theories and relativity, right? And you're saying that the vector potential corresponds to this, and whereas there's nothing to correspond to that. Is that the
they're related, obviously.
Right, in general relativity, actually, this one implies this one. So once you know the metric, then you can deduce the connection from it.
Right.
But maybe the point, if this is helpful, then maybe let me say that gauge invariance pertains, in the case of the ordinary flat space gauge theories, it pertains just to the vector potential. In the case of relativity, it pertains to all of these. And furthermore, anything else that might be present, so there might be some spinner fields, or there might be some scalar fields, or there might be some world lines of matter, and so on, and there might be, anything. So the gauge invariance acts on all of them, just as here it acts also on the charged fields, but it doesn't act on the uncharged fields. But here it acts on everything, and it acts in. But the big difference is that here it acts locally. Right? The gauge transformation says, for example, for A, that A goes to A plus the gradient of some field. So that's a local. So A of, if you put in the arguments here, it's A of X is transforming to A of X, and it only needs to know the gauge parameter here in the neighborhood of X. Whereas here it's transforming non-locally. So that's the crucial difference. So A of X, if you want to know what the new, if you want to know what the GAB prime of X is, that comes from GAB at some other X, some other Y, which is in general not the same point because you're moving points around. So this is a more complicated form of gauge invariance. And that, at a technical level, that causes a lot of grief for, say, quantum gravity.
That sort of explains what you meant by what locality had to do with this. When you said that in passing.
Oh, what I said in passing was that you can, this was related to the flat space gauge. It wasn't this. So in the case of relativity, you don't recover. It would be wrong to say that you recover relativity by passing to the gauge variables. In fact, we don't even know what the gauge invariant variables are in gravity in any simple way. I don't think it's possible in general to name in any simple way anyway, a set of variables that could replace this and would be manifestly gauge invariant. Whereas in the case of electromagnetism, we can. Those are these so-called Wilson loops. I said this afterwards in the discussion with some people, or holonomies as they're called. They're the net phase, you know, e to the ix dot dx integrated around some loop. That's, you could think of as a kind of interference, a phase that occurs in an interference experiment like the Aharonov-Bohm effect and so on. This thing is actually an invariant. If you change the gauge of A, as you can see, because it's a closed loop, this will just change by a gradient, and that gradient will integrate to zero. So if you know the value of this so-called Wilson loop, if you know the value of this holonomy element, then you know fully the gauge field. But there's no more gauge invariance. These things, when you make a gauge transformation, are unchanged. So that actually gives you a gauge independent description. It no longer has redundant elements in the sense that everything here has a direct physical meaning. If you change one of them, you've changed the physical situation. So we actually do have, in the case of electromagnetism, a non-redundant description. But here's where locality comes in. It's very awkward because now instead of giving a field, you know, instead of giving just four numbers at every point, we have to give a number for every curve, every loop in the space-time. And there's immensely more loops in the space-time than there are just points in the space-time. And furthermore, they're not free anymore because the values of these loops are related. So if you take a loop like this and you divide it in two and regard it as the union of this loop with this other loop, with the two interior segments canceling, then it has to give the value. Then there's a relationship that the holonomy for this times the holonomy for this has to equal the holonomy for the whole thing, just the additivity of the integral. And so they're not free data either. So there's complicated relations. If you try and work with those data, you have much more complicated variables to work with and complicated consistency conditions among them. Whereas if you work with the vector potential, well, you pay the price that you have redundant data. Now you have this extraneous information. But far, far fewer variables. They're locally defined, and they're free. They're completely you can choose A as you like anywhere, independently. So you have the complete set of data. So somehow that's why people use this, right? So the description is much easier, even though from a physical point of view, it's less satisfactory than this kind of description. Yeah?
I have a question about the first point. So the points of the manifold are parts of a set. So a manifold itself is a set with some structures on it.
Right.
So almost by definition, they do have individuality. So
question. Yeah, go ahead.
So did you mean, was this a question of different coordinates being on the points or?
No. So when I say they lack individuality, that means, if you like, it means that if we take the physical situation, whatever it is, say a gravitational field and blah, 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 and some electromagnetic fields, some particles moving through, whatever that physical, if you take that physical situation and shuffle around the points of the manifold, just swap them with each other, but in such a way that you leave the field on top of them unchanged, that you haven't changed anything, right? That's what it means. If the points had a true individuality, then just exchanging two of the points would already change the physical situation. So it's like they're in some sense they're indistinguishable in the same sense that identical particles are indistinguishable from each other. Just changing the labels on them does nothing, or changing their actual, right? If there's an electron here and an electron here, then I move the electron and I make them change places, in the end I have the same physical situation. because the electrons in that same sense don't have an individuality. They're individual with respect to protons. They're different particles than protons or positrons. But with respect to each other, in some sense, they're not distinct. They lack this individuality. That's what I meant. Somehow the mathematics forces us to give them an individuality, exactly as you said. It's a set of objects, the points of space-time, and there are these structures on them. And in order to talk about a set of objects, you have to be able to distinguish one from the other. So in that sense, the mathematics gives them the individuality. But since the physics does not, and that's what the gauge invariant is doing for us, it's correcting the mathematics to be closer in touch with the physics. It's forcing us not to talk about things that the mathematics talks about, would let us talk about, that have no physical meaning. Like which point is where, which point in the manifold is where. Okay. So were there other questions on? Okay, so the other remark I wanted to make was just about this issue of the symmetry versus the gauge invariance, and that is, I should have said, remember we said that a symmetry transformation takes place when some subset of the whole universe, when basically you apply a gauge, what would have been a gauge transformation if done globally, you apply it locally, quasi-locally, to some subset, some subsystem, and you don't apply it to the remainder of the universe. But you can't, of course, whereas the gauge invariance is an exact operation, it'll preserve the action, for example, exactly. The symmetry, just if you think about the description I just gave, it's only approximately defined, right? You can't really, no matter how far away we may be from each other, there's some little interaction between us. The space-time between us is not exactly flat and so on. And so if I move myself, it's really, I haven't told you, I can't do it without making even some little change to the environment. And then it's really ill-defined what that little change is. So in that sense, the symmetry is only an approximate thing, and it will only approximately preserve the action, whereas the gauge invariance, the global gauge is exact. So that's the other comment. And then those are all things I meant to say last time, but I don't think I said or didn't emphasize. Then the fourth thing is, someone asked a very interesting question in the afterwards, which was, in the case of a symmetry, as I argued, it doesn't change the action, does it actually produce some sort of boundary term in the action? That was the question. I won't try and answer the question in any detail, but I want to say that, yes, it does. At the time, I couldn't think of the right answer, so now I forgot who asked the question. Are they here? Anyway. Mm-hmm. Oh, you asked the question, right. So I think the good answer to that is, yes, it does, if you apply it in such a way that it even locally changes the situation. So what you have to do is let me just say these words, and then it may resonate with those of you who have a certain familiarity with even classical mechanics. So you have to think of applying this gauge invariance to an entire history or to an entire portion of a history. If we were to take the whole thing and, say, translate it with respect to the environment, well, then the action, except for these small inexactnesses that I referred to here, if we can make this approximation, the action then doesn't change. But if you apply it, I'm thinking here of a translation, if you apply this particular operation, this transformation, which would be locally like a gauge transformation, if you apply it only to the future part of the history and not to the past, So here we just put the identity. We don't touch the past portion. And we do apply it to the future portion. And if you assume that the original configuration satisfied the equations of motion, that's a big assumption, then the resulting change in the action is a boundary term. And in fact, it's basically, so I'll just write it schematically, where dq is a transformation of the final endpoint. So this is a formula you might know from classical mechanics. If you take a world line, which is a solution of the equations of motion, you hold the initial endpoint fixed, and you displace the final endpoint a little bit by dq, that the change in the action is pdq. And in fact, this is the most fundamental way of defining momentum, I think, in the Hamiltonian theory, or in a theory defined by an action principle. So is that familiar? At least some people have seen this before, maybe.
Is it like, that's Hamiltonian?
Well, there's no Hamiltonian here. I haven't introduced a phase space or anything. I'm just working with Lagrangian. So this S is just the integral of L dt along this world line gamma. So this is, you can, of course, introduce P by introducing canonical variables, and then it becomes a canonical variable. But this statement I'm making here doesn't require you to do any of that. It just gets the momentum directly from the variational principle, from the action functional S. And it leads, so the issue of conserved quantities in gravity is a very troubled or very long story. But if you interpret this right, then it leads you to a formula for conserved quantities corresponding to symmetries at infinity, corresponding basically to flat space symmetries. So the 10 conserved quantities that you have in Minkowski space are also present for asymptotically flat regions of systems, subsystems, or regions of space-time. And you can get the value of those conserved quantities by an analysis like this. Okay. But that's presupposing a lot of stuff we haven't really defined yet. But this you can understand just if you think of classical mechanics, just world lines, not field theory even. And it's a useful formula to know. But that's how I would answer the question. So if you take a portion of history and you apply the symmetry to the whole thing, the action won't change except for these tiny corrections. But if you apply it just to the future portion and not the past, and I haven't told you what to do in between, right? But it doesn't matter, because when I'm at a solution of the equations of motion, the variations I do in the interior are zero by definition of the variational principle. Right? That's how the equations of motion say here that the variation, if I limit the variations to the interior and make them vanish at the endpoints, then the variation of the action is supposed to be zero. That's the statement of the variational principle. So you might have worried that this wasn't well defined, because I've only told you what to do at the endpoint or in the neighborhood of the endpoint, but I haven't told, and in the neighborhood of the original initial point, but I haven't told you what to do in the middle. But the answer is it doesn't matter what I do in the middle. It won't change this variation of the action. Okay. If I started a solution. Okay, so those kind of the loose ends. Is there any more questions or comments on this stuff?
But you're still keeping it infinitesimal in the middle, right?
Infinitesimal everywhere, right. So this is supposed to be infinitesimal. So one over a very small number. Yeah, of course, it's all just true to first order. If you go to second order, then you'll get a bulk integral or integral over the whole course of the history.
So this is an analogy to the gauge transformation. So the delta q would be the thing that you're varying in the gauge transformation, right?
If we did a gauge transformation, I would. It would still be a, when if we did, as Siavash said, if we did an infinitesimal gauge transformation, which is really what I'm talking about. If we did it to every, if we did it to the whole history, that would be a, what I was thinking of. That would be an infinite. That would be one of these partial gauge transformations applied to some region and not to the rest. You can't, and that. And that would be, at this approximate level, a well-defined operation. If we do what I said here, it's not actually a gauge transformation anymore, in any sense, because it's something more general than what I call the partial gauge transformation. Because it's true that in this region it looks like a gauge transformation, and it's true in this region it looks like the trivial gauge transformation, but here it just doesn't look like a gauge transformation. It's actually telling us, you know, to it's actually telling us to move the trajectory like this somehow. And so it started as a solution. Now it's no longer a solution, perhaps. Anyway, it's a more drastic physical change. Whereas in this partial gauge transformation, that's a symmetry. Here it looks like a gauge transformation, just like a translation. Out here, it looks like the identity. And there's nowhere where it doesn't look like a gauge transformation. Why? Because in this region where there's nothing present, we're imagining, doing the identity and doing a translation produce the same effect. So the two things are compatible with each other. Whereas that's not true in this case. Okay. So this symmetry, is just as I've defined it, is only changing the relationship of this region to its environment. But here I'm making a change even in the local region. It's not just changing the relate. Anyway, I think maybe the point is clear. Okay. If not, we can take it up again later. Yeah. Okay, so let's go back now to cosmology. So where were we? We were doing Friedmanian cosmology. So we're thinking of a universe like this, cutting it, of course, it's going on in principle forever, or until it hits a singularity, perhaps. But I'm chopping it off at some point, so we'll have a finite action, and we can talk about the variations in the action to get the equations of motion. And remember, because this is topologically S3 cross R, so I'm taking the case of a spherical space, and then it admits a unique slicing in general, in terms of which the individual slices, which I think I called sigma, are completely homogeneous and isotropic. They're just round spheres, as people say. In other words, spheres with the metric of a sphere, not deformed spheres. And then there are just two parameters that, if you specify them for every slice, give you the whole geometry. First, the radius of each slice, which we call A. And second of all, not actually for each individual slice, but for each pair of individually nearby, infinitesimally nearby slices, we specify the time lapse and proper time between them. That's called d tau. Those two data together specify the geometry fully. So I think that should be pretty intuitive, right? And that's sort of where we stop. So this is the kinematical description of this universe. Now let's look at the dynamics. We're going to get it from an action principle, because in relativity, you can't quite overstate, it's important not to overstate the case. We can't say that every equation of relativity comes from an action principle, because in some approximation, there's dissipation, right? So if you're dealing with a star, for example, a star is not a perfect fluid. Perfect fluid in this, in the conventions that are used in, certainly the conventions that are used in relativistic hydrodynamics, perfect fluid means one without viscosity and without heat conduction, no dissipation. But a real star has both viscosity, of course. If it didn't have heat conduction, we wouldn't see it, and it wouldn't keep us warm, and so on. The sun wouldn't keep us warm. So it has those. But if you ignore those, then it's a perfect, it's called a perfect fluid. And in that approximation, we can use an action principle for it, and we can use an action principle for other things. But if we want to take into account viscosity, then we can't use an action principle for it. So it's not true, really, that every equation we work with can be described in an action principle, in terms of an action principle. But what's believed to be true is that every fundamental equation can be described in terms of an action principle. So if you're talking about the star, well, you see dissipation, yes, because you've neglected the microscopic structure of the star. So this macroscopic approximate description has dissipation. But if we go back to the underlying quantum field theory and so on, describe the star in terms of the standard model, then we should be able to, which I wouldn't recommend doing. If we do that, then you should be able to write everything in terms of an action principle. Ultimately, I think the reason people have faith in this is because that's what we need to formulate quantum mechanics, at least in the path integral way of describing it. And in fact, no one knows how to write quantum systems in general unless there's something like an action principle behind it. I think that's a fair statement. So that's probably why we have faith. But in any case, so I'm going to assume that I think in this course, everything, because I don't think we'll do viscosity, at least not this semester. So everything in this course will be under the assumption that there is an action principle. And then furthermore, the total action functional will always be a sum of something associated to pure gravity and something associated to everything else, which also involves gravity, but I won't write it explicitly. In this case, I called it dust. Oh yeah, I forgot to say, this describes the geometry fully, but I haven't finished with the kinematics because I have to also describe the matter that's supposed to be present, which is idealized as all the lumpiness taken out and just some uniform distribution of, I haven't drawn it to be uniform, but this is meant to be all the dust particles. We imagine them in some continuum approximation. These could be, in reality, these could be galaxies or whatever, but imagine them in some continuum approximation where it's just a smooth fluid. And so the only thing that it takes, so to describe them, we need another parameter, just one, which is the total mass, the total rest mass of all these particles. Because of the assumption of symmetry, these particles must be at rest in the cosmic rest frame. That is, they must be moving orthogonally. Their world lines must be orthogonal to these slices, these a constant cosmic time. Okay, so the full description of the kinematics is the scale factor for every slice, dt for every infinitesimally nearby pair of slices, and the total mass involved on any slice, which is, if we assume that the matter is conserved, will be the same for every slice. So just one number, just basically the total number of world lines times the mass of the individual particle that has that world line. So now we have to... So to get the dynamics, we need to know what are these two terms. This term, at this point, because we're trying to look ahead, I won't derive. This is basically the so-called Einstein-Hilbert action. And we'll see later where it comes from. We'll try to motivate it and write the general formula for it. And then we'll come back and show what it reduces to in the case of this Friedmann universe. What I'll do today is just tell you the formula for that. But let's start with this one, because this one we can understand what the action actually is. So if you remember, I think I asked someone last time who quoted the quoted the formula. So what is the action? So we just think of the dust as a collection of particles, freely falling particles, and so there's no forces on them. But we know that for that, this is just a statement from special relativity, we know that, which I assume everyone is very familiar with, that the action is just with the signature that I'm using, which is 1 minus sine for the metric. With that signature, it's just the proper time along the world line times the mass of the particle, right, with a minus sign. So is that familiar to everyone? Most everyone has seen that before. Right? Okay, so that's the action. So what is the action for the... that's for one particle. So the total action for the dust is just n times that. It's minus m times n times the integral d tau. And this thing here we called m, capital M. So it's just equal to minus m times the integral of d tau. So just, which is really, if you like, just the elapsed proper time between the initial and final hypersurfaces. So that's dust. Let's say between the initial and let's call this initial, this final. For gravity now, I'll write down the general formula. So this is the completely general formula. This is called the Ricci scalar. This kappa is the gravitational constant rationalized. This lambda is the cosmological constant, and this V is the four volume of the region that you're evaluating, the space-time region that you're evaluating the action for, where this kappa is sort of the one that's convenient in cosmology. And in some senses, the more natural way of normalizing the gravitation, the Newton's constant, it has this 8 pi. So if you put the 8 pi here, then you know you have a nice dimension-independent expression, basically, just 1/2 in front of the Ricci scalar. Okay, but what are the... Now, first of all, for the rest of this, I'm going to assume that lambda equals 0. So am I going to? No, I haven't assumed it yet. So we'll keep it for a little while. So we'll keep lambda. But again, this term we can work out also. We lost them.
I don't know what that is. It's not from them. Is it a phone? Anybody's phone ringing?
But why is this like a...
I don't know. They keep disconnecting on their side.
Oh.
It doesn't do that every time.
No, it's just the first time. This is the first time it did this.
Thank God.
Okay. Yeah. No. Okay. Where were we? Okay, so let's concentrate for a moment on the term which we can do. So what is the four volume of this region? Well, it's just the union of all these little bits of four volume, right, between adjacent hypersurfaces. And what's the volume of that? Well, the volume, so how do I want to write it? The volume of that is... I guess I don't have a name for it. So, I've called this hypersurface sigma. So the volume of this is obviously, so this little bit of dv in this region is clearly the volume of the three surface sigma times d tau, right? Because it's just the usual formula of the volume being base times height, which is just as valid in four-dimensional geometry as it is in three-dimensional geometry. But what's the volume, and what's the volume of this? This is a sphere, remember. It's a sphere of radius A. So what's the volume of sphere of radius A? Sorry?
It's a three sphere,
a three-dimensional sphere, exactly. So it's, you may remember, it's 2 pi squared. So it's got to be a cubed because it's a three sphere. And then the coefficient in front of it turns out to be 2 pi. I thought I had some little... Oh, yes, we can do this. This is just a useful, I mean, you can look it up, but there's a kind of cute formula for remembering it. Well, so let's assume it for a second that I want to tell you the cute formula for this. So this term here will be minus lambda times the integral dv, which is equal to minus lambda times the integral of 2 pi squared a cubed. D tau, so I can take the 2 pi outside, so it'll just be the, I keep losing the, take the 2 pi squared outside. So that's that term. Let's see if I've got it right. Right, and then what about this term? This term I just have to quote for you, but before doing that, let me just tell you this cute formula. So if you want to know the volume of an n-dimensional, say a d-dimensional disk, or often called ball also, in other words, the solid sphere in that dimension, that can be remembered as pi to the d over 2 over d over 2 factorial. Times r to the d. That's a kind of easily memorable formula. If you think of d over 2 factorial should be interpreted as a gamma function in the case that d is an odd number. Right? So you can amuse yourself by showing that this gives the right answer for 1, 2, and 3 dimensions and so on. Even 0 dimensions, I think. Or no, 1 dimension. You have to start with 1. This is the solid one. Then, well, maybe 0, too. It probably gives 1. If we put in d equals 0, we'll get 1, which is, in some sense, the volume of a point. Right? So, but anyway, you can check that it gives, once it gives the right answer, once you know this, then you can get the volume of the sphere just by differentiating with respect to the radius, right? So if we take, that's d by dr, so that equals d, whatever it is, pi to the d over 2 over d over 2 factorial r to the d minus 1. But that's the n minus 1. Now it's the d minus 1 sphere. Right? So that'll give you the volume of the d minus 1 sphere. If you rewrite it in terms of d, then you'll... Anyway, if you work it out for d equals 4... it should give pi squared. Yeah, 4 over 2 is pi squared. 4 over d is 4. D over 2 is 2. 2 factorial is 2. Yeah. So this whole thing gives 2 pi squared in the case where we're dealing with d equals 4. As I said, or just look it up. So the volume of a three sphere of radius a is 2 pi cubed. Now, finally, we have to do the... write down for you the gravitational action. So I want to define, to make it, yeah, so now you just have to take my word that is the 1 over kappa, of course. Now I have this funny symbol. It's the integral of A times d tau minus this way of writing it might look a little strange to you. I'm just repeating the cosmological constant term now, just to write the total gravitational action. Okay, so this is the... Now, why have I written this not just a simple equal sign? I should say, where did this scalar curvature come from? Maybe something should be said about that. So what this is measuring is, of course, curvature, meaning the deviation from being flat, being looking like a portion of Minkowski space. Now, why does this forward geometry here deviate from being flat? Well, there are two reasons, of course. One is that even at a given moment of time, it's a sphere and not a plane. And the second reason is that its radius is changing with time. So both of those are deviations from flatness. And so you get contributions to the scalar curvature from both of those. And that leads to sort of two terms here. This one is corresponding, well, you can see this depends on the rate, on the change of A, and this one is present even when A is constant. This one has to do with the spatial curvature, and this one has to do with the temporal curvature, meaning the failure to be static. Okay. Now, why have I written this?
Sorry, isn't the top formula already the formula for the volume?
Top? Or which formula?
So,
this is the volume of a solid ball or sphere in dimension d. This is in r to the d. Okay. This is the formula for the volume of the surface of that same ball.
Oh, we just want the surface. So.
Because remember, we can think a two sphere. If we just want to compute the volume of the three sphere. We can think of the three sphere as the surface of a four-dimensional ball or disk embedded in four-dimensional Euclidean space. It's just geometry. We're, of course, not saying there's really some four-dimensional space that's embedded in Euclidean space. Okay? This is no more than the calculation that if I go down to two dimensions and say that this is a disk now, a real disk. So its area is equal to pi r squared. And now we take dA dr, that's equal to 2 pi r. That gives us the circumference. It's just a way of relating the circumference to the area. It's just bumped up to four dimensions.
Excuse me. So for the action of one particle, it seems that you're just taking the integral over the world line of one dust particle.
Yes.
Which, if one varies it, it gives the geodesic effect.
Right.
But my confusion comes from when you look at the whole, all the particles.
We're assuming...
Each one of them is moving in a different geodesic.
Right.
So on which path are you integrating this?
I have to sum it over all the paths. So for each particle, if I were to give the particle a label, I have to compute this integral here for that particle, and then I have to sum it over all the particles. This is because we're assuming that they're not interacting with each other, that they don't collide or anything like that. That's the meaning of the word dust, which is a code word for saying non-interacting particles.
So maybe the reason I'm confused is if you vary the second integral, then it's going to give you one geodesic. But we know that each of the dust particles are moving in on different geodesics.
Right.
So which one of those geodesics is it giving you? If you look at all the dust particles as a whole, does it give you the center of mass of that sphere?
No. So that question, that brings in the whole issue of sort of how to describe a fluid. But if you're willing to live with the idea that really we have a discrete set of dust particles, then if you want the equations of motion of the dust, then, see, we don't need it here, that's the thing, because by symmetry we know what the dust will do. It'll just remain at rest in the cosmic rest frame, because otherwise it would be singling out a direction. And in fact, there's a more subtle issue, which is, let me just mention it, if you're dealing with dust, or in fact, if you're dealing with any perfect fluid, and when you get the equations of motion, what you're pointing out is that you have to vary all the variables that are entering into it, not only the metric, which is what I'm going to vary here when we, as soon as we derive the equations of motion, but you have to also vary the variables that describe the fluid. But it turns out, and this is exactly because of diffeomorphism invariance, that when you're dealing with a perfect fluid, you don't have to worry about varying the fluid variables at all. It suffices to vary the metric. See, because if I vary the fluid variables, I'm just deforming the world line somehow, the flow lines of the fluid. But having done that, now let me perform an overall gauge transformation or diffeomorphism, which brings those varied flow lines back to the original flow lines. Now, of course, I will have to apply it also to the metric, so the metric will be varied. But nevertheless, I've expressed the variation up to a gauge transformation as one in which the fluid flow lines are not varied. So I can get the most general variation just by varying the metric. So, I mean, that's really a way of refusing to answer your question. But now, but I didn't really mean, I mean, but that's a very useful thing to have in mind. But I can also answer your question. If you really wanted to get the, say you were dealing not with such a simple geometry, and you wanted to get the equations of motion for the world lines, then you have to vary each world line independently. If you vary that world line, you get the equations of motion for it. If you vary the world line of another dust particle, you get the equations of motion for it. Okay. But in the fluid, when we make this fluid approximation, then it turns out you lose nothing by just leaving out the variations of the fluid. So where were we? Yeah, so this, oh yeah, I was saying, why have I written not equality, but this funny almost equal sign? The reason is that if you actually were to evaluate that, you would get terms involving, this basically involves the first derivative, the rate of change of A, but it doesn't involve the second derivative. You actually get terms involving both the first and second derivatives, but it's convenient in deriving the equations of motion to do an integration by parts, so you only have to deal with first derivatives. So I've done an integration by, this is hiding that I've done an integration by parts. So the statement is not that they're equal, but they're equivalent up to an overall surface term, which will go to zero when we take the variation. Okay. So now to write this in a slightly more convenient form, to not keep always writing 6 pi squared over kappa, let me just call this, well, it's not that hard, I suppose, to write 6 pi squared over kappa all the time. Let me give that a name of beta, and then the action, the final action, taking everything into account, is the integral of d tau times minus m plus a plus beta a, there's a beta from there, minus beta a dA squared d tau. You might, so now you might find this looking a little bit, what do I mean by dA squared over d tau? If that notation looks ugly to you or confusing to you, you can just you could rewrite it if you would like. dA d tau squared times d tau. But you'll see why it was easy, it was convenient. I mean, if you believe you can cancel one of the d taus, then these are equal. And you'll see in a moment why it's convenient to keep it in this form. Because now quite a lot can be said. It's actually remarkable how many of the sort of characteristic features of relativity you can see already in this simple example. So let me mention. So this one, this term, you see, if you look at it, involves no time derivatives of A at all. So if we imagine this on an analogy with the mechanical system, remember, from mechanics, what is the analogy, what is the action? It's the integral of L dt, and remember L is the kinetic minus the potential energy, so it's really the integral of the kinetic energy, dt, minus the integral of the potential energy, dt. Sometimes, for some reason, this is called t. You often see it written as the integral of t minus v, dt, where v is the potential energy, and t is the kinetic energy. But if we ask how gravity fits into that, well, it fits in pretty well, right? So this, of course, proper time is here playing the role of time. But in here, this would be, by analogy, since it's the bit that doesn't depend on the rate of change of the variable A. The only dynamical variable, if we think of it in this analogy, then T is like the parameter time and A is the dynamical variable. Of course, in reality, both T and A are dynamical variables in gravity. But if we make this analogy, then the dynamical variable is A, and there's no A dots here, so this is the potential energy. And then this term would be the kinetic energy. And the analogy is basically right, except for one thing. I mean, do you see some... there's something wrong with this term, right? Because actually, I should have said that in the analogy, this is really minus the potential energy, right? It's kinetic minus potential. But what about this? This is supposed to be the kinetic energy, but what about this sign, right? It's coming with a minus sign. So the kinetic energy, it looks like a kinetic energy. It has the wrong sign. And I left out. I still meant to be carrying around the cosmological constant term. So let me not get rid of it quite yet. Minus 2 pi. 2 pi lambda a cubed. So this would actually be also part of the potential energy in that case. But you see you have the wrong sign in the kinetic energy, and that's not a mistake. It's one of the things that makes gravity different from all other fields, is that certain of the modes of gravity, what we're seeing here is just one mode, one overall scaling mode. And those certain of the modes, including that overall scaling mode, come in with the wrong sign of the potential energy. Wrong side of the kinetic energy, which in some sense means that you should expect an instability. Well, we know gravity is unstable in some sense. You can start very small and just expand forever, which is fortunate for us. That's why we're here, right? Because we started there. So you can make the analogy, but keep in mind that this wrong sign is for the things. Yeah.
Is it relative to say that this potential or the kinetic term is the wrong minus sign?
Oh, I didn't say that there was a wrong sign here. This is, we
no,
can just
I
define this.
Relative to say that, because I suppose you could redefine S as minus S?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, if the whole world were nothing but this Friedmann universe, if we had perfect spherical symmetry and just dust, then it would be, at least at the classical level, well, at least at any level, I think, it would be meaningless to talk about the overall sign of S. Because classically, all that happens, all we really care about is the variation of S to vanish. And quantum mechanically, all it's going to do is change the phase. I mean, it will perform an overall complex conjugation of the amplitudes, which in the end won't matter either. So that's correct. So when I say that it has the wrong sign, if you looked only at this, you wouldn't see it. When you see it is when you look at more general situations. So if we were to the simplest thing is to look at other modes of the gravitational fields. Consider, for example, gravitational waves propagating in that same space-time. Now it's no longer spherically symmetric. Now there'll be some parameters describing some configuration type parameters corresponding to those gravitational waves. They'll occur with the right sign. So what's really meaningful is that you get both signs in the gravitational action, whereas in all other field theories, you only get the positive sign. You always get the same sign for every mode. That's right. Okay. Yes, and if I were to put in other fields, like a scalar field or whatever, again, like the Klein-Gordon equation or something, the same thing would happen. You would see that you would get a positive sign for the time derivative squared instead of a negative sign. But that's a good question. Okay, now we have to do the variation. So this is the action. So now the equations of motion, we already said what they are. They come, but there's an important subtlety which I have to say something about, which is that the equations of motion don't really say that the variation of the action is zero always. What they say, they get erased. Somewhere I had written down this PDQ. Oh, here it is, yeah. What they really say is that the variation of the action reduces to a surface term. Only if you make the variation to be zero on the boundary can you say that the variation of the action is zero. Okay. So we need to consider the most general variation, which vanishes on the boundary. And then we meet, and then we have this equation. That'll lead us to the equations of motion. Yeah, there was a question.
Yeah. Up there you have S is equal to, and you have lambda to the fourth B.
Lambda to the fourth?
Yeah.
That would be a mis- No, no. It's not lambda to the fourth. Yeah, it's a superscript on V, the four volume.
Oh, okay.
The four-dimensional volume as opposed to the three-dimensional volume.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was. I had a bad feeling when I was writing it that it might look like lambda to the fourth. I should have left a big space, like lambda, and then four V, something like that. I did accidentally write lambda squared here, but I didn't remember writing lambda to the fourth anyway. Okay, so we have to make this variation in such a way that, now we have to look at this picture, in such a way that we don't change any of the physical fields near the boundary, and then we're guaranteed to have the action be stationary, that is, to first order, not to change. We're guaranteed, rather, that if we satisfy the equations of motion, we'll have this, and vice versa. So the equations of motion have to be whatever comes from making the most general variation of this sort. But now comes an important subtlety, which you could go off into wild flights of BRST treatment of blah, 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 blah. But there's actually a very simple geometrical factor, which is that if I don't change anything about the metric, about the geometry itself, in the neighborhood of the initial hypersurface, and if I don't change anything in the neighborhood of the final hypersurface, I can still change. It doesn't stop me from changing dt arbitrarily in the interior. So what I have to hold fixed is dt near the final boundary and dt near the initial boundary. But it doesn't mean, but I can change dt in the interior as I like. That means that the total elapsed time can change, right? So you might, if you looked at this formula that I had before, you might look at this and say, treat this as a time in the mechanical analogy, we should hold T fixed at the final and initial boundary. That's not right, because T is not actually a parameter time. DT is representing a component of the metric. I hope, is it clear? If it's not entirely clear, we could put it, then we could jump ahead. Most people will have seen, you know, DT will be given by dx0 squared. This will be a formula for dt, right? D tau, sorry. Okay, just, I'm assuming everyone will have probably seen this before. What, another way of saying what I'm saying here is that you can vary g00 in what needs to be held fixed at the initial and final boundaries are the value of g00. But I can change it freely. And since I can change it freely, I can change d tau freely. And if, since I can do that, it means that the value of tau, if I were to give the hypersurfaces labels, then the value of that label on the final hypersurface could change, would in general have to be allowed to change. That's why I was careful not to label these by a value, by a parameter tau. Okay? So now I get to do two variations. What were my dynamical data? My dynamical data, here we go. My dynamical data were A, dt, d tau, and m. M really doesn't change because of conservation of mass, so I don't have to worry about that. However, dt and a both can be varied freely. So let's look at what we get when we vary d tau. I keep saying t, but I should be saying d tau. So vary d tau. What do I get? So I'll get an overall term of the variation of d tau, and then I'll have, so, well, here it's obvious what I'll get, minus m plus beta a. Here I want to vary d tau, so it's in the denominator, so I'll get plus beta a dA squared d tau squared. And here I'll get minus 2 pi squared lambda, just like over there, a cubed. So it's very simple. This has to be zero for arbitrary variations of this d tau. Okay. So therefore, it just means that this whole thing is zero. I mean, it means that the thing within the square brackets are zero. So my equation of motion is actually very simple. If I rearrange it a little bit, it just says beta a d tau squared plus beta a minus m minus 2 pi squared lambda times a cubed equals 0. So this is the equation of motion that results, and it's with a slight rearrangement of some of the factors, it's what's called the Friedmann equation. In fact, I want to say something just a little bit later about the rearrangements of the factors, but let's now look at the solutions. Well, two comments. First of all, why did I not vary? What about varying A? What would happen if you vary A? It turns out that because everything is so simple, this has the name of the Friedmann equation. It has another name, which is the Hamiltonian constraint. They're really the same. They're just two different names for the same thing, depending on where you thought of them coming from. But there's another equation. But because of the high degree of symmetry, it turns out that this equation has essentially all the information in it already. We don't have to bother with the other equation. So we can also vary A. But I'll leave it as an exercise. Maybe I'll even make it a homework. I'm not sure if I'll include that homework. But you can convince yourself that if you do that, essentially you got nothing new. So let's look now at the solution of this. So let's just to make it look a little more familiar, let's divide through by beta A. Remember, beta was just 6, I don't know, forget what it was, 6 pi over kappa or something, 6 pi squared over kappa. It's just a number. By the way, you might, another reason that I gave this a name is not only that it's so hard, it's not really that it's so hard to write 6 pi squared over kappa here and there. It's also because this depended on the particular choice of topology. Suppose I had used a different spherical universe, a universe which locally looked like a sphere, but topologically just different from a sphere. For example, it might have been the sphere with antipodes identified, just the simplest case. Then the volume of the three space would have been a little, it wouldn't have been 2 pi squared times a cubed. It would have been, in that case, just pi squared times a cubed. But with different topologies, there's a whole infinite family, so-called, spherical spaces, which include things like lens spaces and can't think of the names of the others, but there's other spaces which are quotients of the three sphere by finite groups. There's an infinite family of them, and for each of them, you'd get a different coefficient here. But if we keep this beta in this form beta, then it'll always look like this, but just possibly with a different choice of beta. Well, I would have to change this term if there's a cosmological constant also. Okay. So what are the equations? Let's just look, not to try to solve this exactly yet, but just to look at sort of qualitatively what kind of cosmologies will this produce. So to do that, it's convenient to divide through by this beta A, and then we'll just get d tau squared minus m over beta A minus m. That was a plus. What do I have? Minus kappa lambda over 3 times a squared equals minus 1. Where did this? Yeah, so here I did something. Here I didn't, instead of keeping in terms of beta, I went back to kappa. I substituted for beta, but I didn't substitute here. Anyway, so this, is this right? Does that look right? Yeah.
Can you explain why the kinetic term changed sign on variation?
Oh, it didn't. Oh, yes, it changed sign because d tau is in the denominator. So I just varied, where is it?
Okay.
So I just differentiated with respect to d tau. So the reason for writing it this way is that it gives rise to, you can analyze it in terms of this sort of effective potential, or whatever the right word is, so which I'll call W. Now, just to simplify, I will finally assume that the cosmological constant is 0, which is, of course, wrong. But it makes this analysis a little simpler. Then let's read this as a conservation. This is just a one-dimensional mechanics problem. So let's read this equation as if tau was ordinary time, a was just distance. Then this would be up to a factor of m over 2 if there was a mass. This would just be the kinetic energy. And this would then be the potential energy, right? So the statement, let's read it as the statement kinetic plus potential equals total energy. in this analogy, of course, the total energy is minus one. The way, if I want to use my usual intuition, then I have to make the kinetic energy positive. And then with that convention, then the total energy turns out, which was just coming from this term here, would be minus one. Okay. So, and this is the potential, right? So the potential is just this term here, m over beta A plus minus m over beta A. And I'm going to set this to zero now. So that's a simple enough potential. So what is minus m over beta A? It looks like something like this. This is A. This is the potential. And the total energy is minus one. So now imagine the particle rolling in this potential. What will it do if its total energy has to be here? Well, if its total energy has to be here, then it has to be confined to the left of this. And it can be anywhere down here. And so clearly what it'll do is, if you go back to minus time being minus infinity, it'll climb up here until it reaches this turning point here, and then it'll roll back down. So in terms of what that means in terms of the space-time interpretation is that it starts at zero size, singularity, as we know. It expands to some finite size, and then it rolls back down. What was this curve? This curve was minus m over beta A. Minus m over beta A. So what governs actually how, what governs how big it will be when it turns around and starts recontracting? Well, this has to equal minus one, right, at the turning point here. So the bigger the mass, the bigger A will be at this turning point. So the only real parameter in this family of cosmoses is the total rest mass. And otherwise, the behavior is always the same, expanding from zero size, infinitely fast, reaching a maximum, and going back. Yeah.
How can we see that we would reach the fixed point in finite time?
The way to see it, you'd have to integrate the elapsed time between... Yeah, you can't see it just from this, but it depends, of course, on how steep this curve is. Although, I don't see where else it can go. I mean, since it can't go below A equals zero.
No, I mean, in principle, it could basically approach the fixed point as time goes to infinity, for example.
Oh, you mean it could go, oh, I see. You're worried about it this end.
Yeah.
It could sort of slow down and never reach it. It would do that. Well, this is just mechanics, right? It would do that fixed point was the top of was a maximum of the potential. Then it actually does take it an infinite time to approach that. But if you're going up a hill that's not of zero steepness, then you'll turn around in a finite time and come back. So it's because this crosses at finite slope and not at zero slope. Okay, so it's clear what will happen, and that's, I'm sure if you read some popular accounts of cosmology, then you'll have run across that description, that the closed universe, without the cosmological constant, which used to be the case that everyone talked about without mentioning it, so without the cosmological constant in the closed universe, and matter dominated, in other words, dust and not radiation, all it ever does is expand to a finite size and then recontract. That's the only possibility. If we go and put in a non-zero lambda, then the effective potential will be a more complicated shape, and there'll be other, many different profiles that it can follow, many different kind of life histories that the universe can have. But this is an illustration. This is only meant really as by way of illustration. We're not really doing cosmology in anything like full. We're just trying to illustrate how the Einstein equations work, or how the dynamics of gravity works. Oh, and by the way, for if we were doing flat space instead of the spherical, if the spatial sections were flat and not spherical, which is, as far as anyone knows, the best approximation to the real cosmos we're in, then you would have to drop this. You would drop this term because that, if you trace it back, that came from the spatial curvature. So that's about all for the cosmology. There was one. Oh, yeah, I wanted to. I've lost something. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I wanted to make a couple of more remarks. But that's basically it. So, are there any questions on this, what we've done here?
Isn't it a bit strange that the more massive these dust particles are, the bigger
the bigger, yes. Yeah. Yes, I guess it is, yeah. You mean because there's any more mass, more attraction, so it should be smaller. Yes, maybe. I don't know. One way of seeing it is that if you treat mass, if you make everything dimensionless by setting this gravitational constant to one, then mass has the dimensions of length. Unlike in what you might be used to from quantum field theory, where you set h bar and c to one and then dimension, it's at inverse length. But in gravitational setting, there's no quantum mechanics going on here. So mass essentially has dimensions of length. So the bigger the mass, I mean, if there's a characteristic length, then it should scale with the mass. That's the same as a black hole, right? The mass of the black hole is proportional to its radius. And that
doesn't
one over.
Come from the assumption of homogeneity? Because
everything here comes from the assumption.
If we were to have collapse, it would get out of, it would not be homogeneous anyway. So all this would not be correct anymore.
You mean collapse of some region within the cosmos?
Collapse of matter.
Collapse of the matter, right. But the whole thing does collapse, right? I mean, it does expand and then it collapses.
But in a homogeneous way.
In a homogeneous way, yeah. It's an overall, it's not a localized. I don't know what to say. Yeah, would your intuition, how many people have the intuition that the more mass is in the universe, the smaller it should be? And how many have the opposite? I don't think I have a strong intuition either.
Is the amount of mass, that probably is also related to the time, well, some notion of time that it takes for reclass.
It will, because there's really only one scale here, which is the total mass. And so, yeah, exactly. It'll live longer and it'll get to a bigger size. Yes, I don't know. There's probably some good way of thinking about it that would make it more intuitive, but I don't know what it is.
And don't we have to take also into account the inertia, more mass and more inertia?
That seems like a good argument. Yeah, so it has to. So it's it's expanding rapidly, sort of infinitely rapidly. It takes it longer to slow down.
Also,
yeah, maybe I don't.
Gravity should also be getting weaker as it gets bigger, because they're getting all points getting further apart.
The attraction is getting weaker, but you see that here. It's expanding from measured in terms of. Well, you don't quite see it, but if you treat time, proper time as your time, that's the analogy we're using here, then you see that here, obviously, it's moving infinitely rapidly. So it's expanding at an infinite rate. And as it goes up, it slows down, finally.
Is inertia really a good argument? Because then the equivalence thing comes in.
I don't know. I wouldn't push any of the, if I was confident in any one of them, I would propose that one, but I'm not. But I think the simplest argument is the dimensional one that I gave. That if in the end there's only one parameter of this set of family of solutions, and if it's a total mass, then it must be a size parameter, because the only dimensional constant that's going into it is this kappa. And if you set it to one, then mass scales like size and not inversely like size.
Okay.
What if you started from the beginning with 1 over m in the equation, in the action, and then...
What if I put 1 over m in the action instead of m? I don't know, why would I...
No, then,
then I would be calling 1 over m m or something. I don't see it, it's any different. It's just a parameter in the action. But we know that it is the mass. Remember, we derived, that term we did derive somewhere. Somewhere right up here. This thing is, that's this one that I, this one here, that we already know from special relativity. So it's not just that I made up some parameter, I actually derived that parameter. Okay. What?
So, because the mass is there in the potential energy term, so naturally the more mass there is, the more potential energy term, bigger it is. So it will expand to a bigger size. And
say it again, the mass is present in?
In the potential energy term.
In the potential energy term, right. Yes. Yeah, that's how it works, right? If the mass is greater, I guess it must mean that the curve looks like this. It's more negative, right? And that means it crosses this minus one at a larger.
Yeah, I guess that's.
I mean, it's in the equation. There's no doubt that it's in the equations. I think the question.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. One should be able to. It's consistent. It's consistent with the equations, but the question is why.
My point was that in the action principle that we're using, there the mass is there in the potential energy term, so the root of the problem is there.
Yes, right. That's right.
We didn't have 1 upon m there.
We didn't have 1 upon m. Right?
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. And that's, if you like, for dimensional orders. If you were to trace through what the dimensions of the action should be, you would see that you needed to have an m and not a 1 over m. If you believe the one overall 1 over kappa. Anyway, I think maybe there's not even really time for the final remarks. Let me draw in what we would get. This is, most of you will know, this choosing a spherical spatial section is called this little k equals 1. That's the jargon for having sphere. If you have k equals 0, that's flat, and if you have, maybe I should just say k positive, that looks a little nicer than k equals 1. And if k is negative, you'd have, then the total, if you trace through, the total energy, everything would look the same except the total energy would be shifted. So changing the spatial geometry just has the effect really of shifting where the energy, the zero of energy is. That's something that I should have sort of stressed, is that in an ordinary mechanical system, you're used to the energy being a free constant of integration. It can be anything, although it can't be too negative in general, but otherwise it can be anything. Here there's no choice. The thing that's playing the role of the energy is just minus one. So there's not a whole one parameter family. Once we fix the mass and everything, there's not a whole one parameter family of solutions with different total energy. There's just one solution. And that traces to the fact ultimately that in a certain sense in a closed universe, the total energy really should be thought of as zero. In other words, this analogy is perfectly fine for analyzing mathematically the nature of the solutions. But if you want to think more physically about what's going on, it's better to put this on the other side and make the total energy zero. That gives rise to the Friedmann equation in another form. So next time I'll mention that other form, and then we'll go on to develop some of the mathematics that we need to go beyond such a simple case and handle generic gravitational fields. That'll mean we'll start talking about manifolds in general. So that's next time. I'll start defining manifolds, tangent vectors, those kind of things. What we'll talk about is the basic structures of a space-time that it inherits from the equivalence principle. And it was, the equivalence principle tells us that locally, this is just a little preview. So the equivalence principle tells us that locally we can't distinguish curved space-time from flat space-time. And if you ask, what are the basic structures of flat space-time? You can say, first of all, it's a four-dimensional object. It's a manifold. Second of all, it's a vector space. It's a flat, in a certain sense, four-dimensional object. It has parallelogram law in addition to vectors. Third of all, it has a metric, which gives proper time and so on, the Minkowski metric. And fourth of all, it has a notion of causal structure, which is very important, light cones. The space-time of general relativity inherits all of those, and we'll see the correspondence. However, they all become a little more complicated. The idea of vector becomes tangent vector and so on. So we'll just go through those generalizations, and then we'll have the tools that we need to go further with the physics. Okay, so that's next time.